in Delamere's apartment, as he'd done, was due to the presence of her demon in each one. And now he knew that her demon was travelling alone, along a great river. It only remained to discover which one, and that wouldn't take long. An excellent evening, all told. Chapter 18. Malcolm in Geneva. Malcolm's eyes were giving him trouble. The spangled ring, which he thought of as his personal aurora, had been trembling just out of sight for days. Not continuously, but for longer than usual, and never quite appearing. It was as if the world was being projected by a magic lantern on a screen that wasn't quite securely fastened. Asta, too, although she couldn't see the ring as he could, was aware of something uneasy in their vision. They reached Geneva late on a windy afternoon, when the skies were dark with both the approaching evening and a threatening storm. The city was busy because the Magisterial Congress was just coming to an end. In truth, Malcolm had no need to go through Geneva, and doing so could even have been called reckless, but it would be useful to learn what had been discussed. Besides, he knew that Simon Talbot was attending the Congress, and he wanted to find him if he could. He planned to leave the city by train, but he arrived by bus, because bus stops were less often watched by the authorities than railway stations. He and Asta got off in a dreary suburb, an area of small factories, market gardens, timber yards, and the like. The road ran along the lakeshore for a short way, and in the rapidly gathering dark, they could see the lights across the water on the fashionable side of the city, and the great snow-covered mountains beyond, ghostly under the moonless sky. There was a yacht club or something of the sort over there, and in the blustery air they could hear the tapping of the rigging wires against the masts like 1,000 Swiss clocks. They walked on a little way. Malcolm stopped and rubbed his eyes. "I can feel it too," said Asta. "It's as if the damn thing snapped and all the spangles got blown everywhere. If it doesn't make its mind up, we'll have to lie down, but I'd much rather not."
"Talbot."
"That's right. I want to. Wait a minute." He was peering at the rusty padlocked gate of a large house behind a stone wall.
"What is it?" she said, and jumped up to his shoulder.
"Something there." It was nearly dark. Something was moving or fluttering on the gate. He thought at first it was a leaf caught in a spider's web, and next that it might have been some kind of glowworm. But then it resolved into something familiar. The spangled ring itself. It was flickering in the semi-darkness over the heavy padlock, and it drew him towards itself as if it were reeling in a fish. He went willingly. Asta couldn't see it herself, but she felt the old excitement that came to him. He reached out towards the twisting, shimmering vision. He wanted to pick it up and hold it in the palm of his hand, knowing that of course he couldn't. But as he touched the padlock, the shackles slipped out of the body with a smooth click, as if it had been recently oiled. The lock hung loose on the hasp.
"Well," said Asta, "gotta go in there now."
They looked in both directions and saw no one. Malcolm removed the padlock and opened the gate, with the spangled ring still flickering in the center of his vision. The gate creaked, but moved easily enough through the weeds that clogged the gravel. The house itself was tall and entirely dark, the windows boarded up, ivy climbing the walls. Its main entrance faced the lake. Malcolm closed the gate, and they made their way towards the building.
"Very un-Swiss, all this neglect," Malcolm said. "Can you see that?"
He was pointing past the house towards the trees at the bottom of the garden right on the shore.
"Boathouse?" said Malcolm. "I think so, yes."
It was just a dark rectangle to his human eyes, but the spangled ring encircled it with brilliance and certainty. They followed the path down towards it, where the gravel was thick with grass and weeds. At least they made no noise as they walked along it. The door of the boathouse was padlocked, but the wood in which the hasp was set was soft and rotten. Malcolm pulled it away easily, and they stepped inside, Asta first for safety, because Malcolm's vision was now almost totally occupied by the shimmering dazzle of the scotoma.
"Don't move," said Asta. "Just stay there by the door. I'll see for you. There's a boat here, some kind of dinghy or small yacht. It's got a mast, and there are oars. There's a name. Mignon.
Malcolm felt his way down the wall until he was kneeling on the wooden planking, and then reached out into the dark until his hand met the little boat's gunwale. He felt it sway slightly as a ripple passed under the gates, and then he felt another little movement as Asta jumped aboard.
"What are you doing?" he said. "Just exploring. It's bone dry inside. No leaks. How are you seeing now?"
"It's clearing a bit. What about the mast and the rigging?"
"Can't tell what's here and what isn't. It all seems in good shape, though."
The spangled ring was getting larger now, and drifting towards him in the way it had. The rest of his vision was returning to normal. He could see the boat dimly against the light from the water outside.
"Well," he said, "nice to know you, Mignon."
He ran his hand along the gunwale and stood up to let Asta lead the way out. Since the wood holding the hasp was perished, he put a stone on the ground against the door to keep it shut. Asta jumped up to his shoulder again and looked all around.
"It led us here," she said as they went back up the path towards the road.
"Of course it did.
I mean, it was blatant."
"Rude to ignore it," he said.
Rucksack on his back, small suitcase in hand, he set off towards the city, with Asta padding tirelessly ahead. The Magisterial Congress was holding its final plenary session. The discussions had been rigorous and exhaustive, but a spirit of unity and concord prevailed, and the election of members to the new Representative Council had proceeded smoothly and effectively. It was almost a miracle, as more than one delegate remarked to another, how everything had gone so well, without a whisper of rancor or jealousy or suspicion. It was as if the Holy Spirit had possessed the entire gathering. The prefect of the Secretariat of the Holy Presence, whose efficient staff had organized everything, was widely praised. The name of the first president of the High Council, as it was going to be called, had taken everyone by surprise. A series of votes had been carried out under conditions of the strictest security, and the winner was announced with great solemnity to be St. Simeon Papadakis, the Patriarch of the Sublime Porte. It was a surprise, because the Patriarch was so old, but immensely holy, as everyone agreed, a very spiritual man. He seemed to be illumined by a divine light. Photograms, once carefully printed, confirmed the fact. There could be no better representative of the sanctity of the entire magisterium than this modest and kindly man, so wise, so learned, so spiritual. The news of his election was announced at a press conference, and subsequently much discussed at, among other places, the Café Cosmopolitain. Malcolm knew from earlier visits that it was the first place to go for political and diplomatic gossip. When he arrived, he found the place crowded with visitors, clerics, foreign correspondents, embassy officials, academics, and delegates to the Congress with their entourages. Some were waiting for a train. Some were continuing agreeable expense account conversations that had begun over lunch with representatives of the press or news agencies or possibly even spies. The Congress would have profound and lasting effects on international relations, certainly including the balance of power in Europe. Naturally, the world wanted to know all about it. Malcolm had been a journalist several times on previous missions, and he played the part well. As he looked around the Cosmopolitan, there was nothing to distinguish him from a dozen others. And before long, he saw the person he was looking for, in conversation with a man and a woman whose faces he recognized. They were literary journalists from Paris. Malcolm made for their table and stopped, pretending to be surprised.
"It's Professor Talbot, isn't it?" he said.
Simon Talbot looked up. There was a slight risk that he'd recognize Malcolm, who was, after all, a scholar of his own university. But Malcolm was ready to take that chance, and in any case, he knew that he had done, said, or published nothing that was likely to catch Talbot's attention.
"Yes, that's right," said Talbot agreeably.
I'm afraid I don't know you, sir.
Matthew Peterson, Baltimore Observer, Malcolm said. I don't want to interrupt you, but...
I think we had finished, said the Frenchman.
His colleague nodded and closed her notebook. Talbot leaned across to shake hands with them both, smiling warmly, and gave them each one of his cards.
May I? Said Malcolm, indicating a vacant chair.
By all means, said Talbot.
I don't know your journal, Mr. Peterson. The Baltimore Observer. It's a monthly specializing in literary and cultural matters. We have a circulation of 80,000 or so, mostly across the Atlantic. I'm the European correspondent. I was wondering how you regarded the outcome of the Congress, Professor.
Intriguing, said Talbot, with another ready smile. He was a slim, dapper man of 40 or so, with eyes that could seemingly twinkle at will. His voice was light and musical, and Malcolm could see how he would shine in a lecture room. His demon was a blue macaw. He went on, I dare say many people will be surprised to hear about the elevation of the patriarch to this new position, to this, ultimate authority, but having spoken to him, I can testify to the simple goodness he embodies. It was a wise decision, I think, to entrust the leadership of the magisterium to a saint, rather than to a functionary.
A saint? I've seen him referred to as Saint Simeon. Is that a courtesy title?
The Patriarch of the Sublime Porte holds the title of saint, ex officio.
And the president of the new council will really be the first leader of the entire church since Calvin renounced the papacy?
Undoubtedly. That's why the council was created.
Malcolm was making shorthand notes as Talbot spoke. In fact, he was writing random words in the Tajik alphabet.
Talbot lifted his empty glass and put it down again.
Oh, I'm sorry, Malcolm said. May I buy you a drink?
Kirsch, thank you.
Malcolm waved at a waiter and said, Do you think a single leader is the best form of government for the magisterium to adopt?
In the flux of history, every kind of leadership emerges and then vanishes again. I wouldn't presume to say that one was better than another. Those terms are the currency of journalism, shall we say, rather than scholarship.
His smile became especially charming. A scowling waiter took Malcolm's order, and Talbot lit a cheroot.
I've been reading The Constant Deceiver, said Malcolm. It's had a big success. Were you expecting a response like that?
Oh, no, not at all. Far from it. But I think perhaps it struck a note that resounded among younger people, especially.
Your exposition of universal scepticism is very powerful. Is that the reason for its success, do you think?
Oh, I wouldn't like to say.
I'm intrigued, you see, to find someone so closely associated with that position praising someone for his simple goodness.
But the Patriarch is good. You have only to meet him.
Shouldn't there be some sort of caveat?
The waiter brought their drinks. Talbot leaned back comfortably and puffed at his cheroot.
Caveat? He said.
Well, for example, you might say that he's a transparently good man, but goodness itself is a problematic idea.
A loudspeaker crackled into life and announced in three languages that the Paris train would be leaving in 15 minutes. A number of people finished their drinks, stood up and put on their coats, looked around for their luggage. Talbot sipped his kirsch and looked at Malcolm as if he were a promising pupil.
I think my readers are capable of detecting irony, he said. Besides, the article I shall write for the Journal of Moral Philosophy will be couched in rather more nuanced terms than I might use if I were writing for the Baltimore Observer, shall we say.
The twinkle that accompanied that shaft of would-be scholarly wit suddenly reduced it to mere vulgarity. Malcolm was interested to see that Talbot didn't realize it.
What did you think of the quality of debate at the Congress? He said.
Very much what one might expect. Most of the delegates were men of the cloth, and their preoccupations were naturally clerical. Matters of ecclesiastical law, liturgy, that sort of thing. Though there were one or two speakers who impressed me with their breadth of vision. Dr. Alberto Tiramani, for example, who I think is the head of one of the bodies represented at the Congress. Certainly a subtle intellect.
something not often combined, as I'm sure you'll have noticed, with a striking clarity of utterance.
Malcolm wrote busily for a moment or two. I read an article recently, he said when he'd finished, which made an interesting comparison between your remarks about veracity and the arbitrary nature of language on the one hand, and the swearing of oaths to tell the truth in courts of law on the other.
Really? Said Talbot. How fascinating.
His tone made the words sound like an example of irony, performed for the benefit of the stupid.
Who was the writer of the article?
George Paston.
I don't think I've ever heard of him, Talbot said.
Malcolm was watching closely. Talbot's response was perfect. He sat back, comfortably, calm, slightly amused, enjoying his cheroot. Only his macaw demon reacted, shifting from foot to foot on Talbot's shoulder, turning her head for a moment to look at Malcolm, then turning away. Malcolm made another note and said, "Do you think it's possible to tell the truth?" Talbot let his eyes brighten. "Ah, well, where should I begin? There are so many. Imagine you're talking to the readers of the Baltimore Observer, straightforward people, who like a straightforward answer."
"Are they? How depressing. What was the question again?"
"Is it possible to tell the truth?"
"No,"
Talbot smiled and went on. "You'd better explain the paradox in that answer. I'm sure your readers would enjoy it if it were set out in simple words."
"In a court of law, then, you wouldn't consider yourself bound by an oath to tell the truth?"
"Oh, I should do my best to obey the law, naturally." "I was intrigued by your chapter in The Constant Deceiver about demons," Malcolm went on.
"I'm so glad.
Do you know Gottfried Brander's The Hypercharasmians?"
"I know of it. Isn't it some sort of best-seller? I don't think I could face it."
The macaw demon was definitely uncomfortable. Asta, sitting on Malcolm's lap, made no move. Her eyes were fixed on the macaw. Malcolm could feel her tension. Talbot finished his drink and looked at his watch.
"Well, fascinating as this has been, I must go. I don't want to miss my train. Good evening, Mr. Peterson."
He held out his hand. Malcolm stood up to shake it and looked directly at the blue macaw, who looked back at him for a moment, but then turned her head away.
"Thank you, Professor," Malcolm said. "Bon voyage."
Talbot swung a rusty brown tweed cloak around his shoulders and picked up a large briefcase. A sharp nod, and he left.
"That was a draw," said Asta. "I'm not so sure. I think he won. Let's see where he's really going."
A moment in the cloakroom to put on a pair of heavy glasses and a black beret, and Malcolm, with Asta on his shoulder, slipped out into the rain-washed street. There was a heavy drizzle, and most people were walking fast, heads down under their hats or hoods. The black mushrooms of a dozen or more umbrellas filled Malcolm's eyeline, but the blue macaw was impossible to hide.
"There she is," said Asta, "going away from the station, as we thought."
The lights from shop windows picked out the demon vividly, but Talbot was walking fast, and Malcolm had to hurry to keep him in sight. The man was doing what Malcolm himself would have done if he knew he was being followed, checking in shop windows for a reflection of what was behind him, slowing down unpredictably and then speeding up again, and crossing the road just before the traffic lights changed.
"Let me go after him," said Asta.
It was much easier to follow someone if two of you were doing it, but Malcolm shook his head. The street was too busy. It would be too conspicuous.
"There he goes," he said.
Talbot was turning into the narrow street where Malcolm knew La Maison Juste was situated. After a few moments, he disappeared from sight. Malcolm didn't follow.
"You really think he won?" said Asta.
"He's a lot cleverer than Benny Morris. I shouldn't have tried to catch him out. She gave him away, though. Well, maybe a draw. But I still think he shaded it. We better go and find a train. I don't think he'll be safe here for very long."
"His name is Matthew Pelsted," Talbot said. "He's a scholar of Durham College, historian. I recognized him at once. Almost certainly an agent of theirs. He knew about my connection with that lout of a policeman who bungled the incident by the river, which means that by now the other side will have got hold of Hassel's notes and other things.
Marcel Delamere listened impassively and watched him across the gleaming desk. "Did you give anything away?" he said.
"I don't think so. He's fairly sharp, but fundamentally a bumpkin."
"I don't know that word.
A rustic oaf."
Delamere knew that Talbot's philosophy maintained that nothing was anything fundamentally, but he didn't question what the Oxford man said. If the phrase useful idiot had existed in their world, it would have expressed his opinion of Talbot precisely. The macaw demon was looking at Delamere's white owl, preening her feathers, bobbing her head, moving from claw to claw. The owl kept her eyes closed and paid no attention. Delamere pulled a notepad towards himself and took up his silver pencil.
"Can you describe him?" he said.
Talbot could, and did, in considerable detail, much of it correct. Delamere wrote swiftly and meticulously. "How did he know about your connection with the incompetent policeman?" he said when he'd finished.
"That remains to be discovered.
If he's a bumpkin, your arrangement can't have been well hidden. If it was well hidden, he's not a bumpkin. Which is it?"
"Perhaps I'm overemphasizing his..."
"Never mind. Thank you for coming in, Professor. I shall be busy now." He stood to shake hands, and Talbot gathered his cloak and his briefcase and left, obscurely humiliated, though he wasn't sure how. But his philosophy soon made that feeling disappear. At the station, Malcolm found a confused crowd of travellers waiting in frustration, and an official of the railway company trying to explain why they couldn't board the train for Venice and Constantinople as they were expecting to, and as he was too. It was already crowded, and apparently one entire carriage had been requisitioned at the last minute for the exclusive use of the new president of the High Council. Passengers who had booked seats in that carriage would have to wait for the train on the following day. The railway company had tried to find an extra carriage, but none were available, so they were now trying to find hotel rooms so the disappointed passengers could stay overnight. People around Malcolm were complaining loudly.
"A whole carriage? Well, he's supposed to be a humble, modest man. Give him a title and all of a sudden he becomes a monster of arrogance."
"No, you can't blame him. It's his entourage, insisting on new privileges.
Apparently the order came from the prefect of the secretariat. Surprising, given how well everything else was organised. Absurd. Exceptionally inconsiderate. I have an extremely important meeting in Venice tomorrow. Do you know who I am?"
"They should have thought of this a long time ago."
"Why does he need a whole carriage, in God's name?"
And so on. Malcolm scanned the notice boards, but there were no more departures that evening except local trains to small towns nearby, and one more train for Paris just before midnight. And he wasn't going to Paris. Asta looked around.
"Can't see anyone who looks dangerous," she said. "Talbot wasn't getting this train, was he?"
"I should think he'd be going in the opposite direction. He'll be getting that late one for Paris."
"Are we going to wait for them to find us a hotel room?"
"Certainly not," said Malcolm, who was watching three more officials hurrying towards the crowd with leaflets and clipboards and sheets of paper. "They'll make a list of who everyone is and where they've put them. I think we'd better be anonymous." Suitcase in hand, rucksack on his back, Asta padding beside him, he left the station quietly and set off to find a room for the night. The president of the High Council of the Magisterium, the patriarch of the sublime port St. Simeon Papadakis, was humbly conscious of being the cause of all this trouble, and settled into his seat in the reserved carriage with deep unease.
"I don't like this at all, you know, Michael," he said to his chaplain. It's unjust. I did try to protest, but they simply wouldn't listen."
"I know, Your Serenity, but it's for your own protection and convenience."
"Well, that shouldn't matter. I do so dislike being the cause of inconvenience to those other passengers. They are all worthy people, all on holy business, all with appointments to keep and travel connections to make. I don't think it's right at all.
As the new president, though?
Well, I don't know. I should have insisted harder, Michael. I should have started in the way I'd like to go on. Simplicity, not ostentation. Would our blessed Savior agree to sitting apart from his fellow passengers? They should have asked me first, you know, before causing all this trouble. I should have put my foot down.
Inadvertently, the chaplain looked down at the patriarch's feet, and then away again. The old man was wearing galoshes over the much-repaired black shoes he wore every day, and something was troubling him. He couldn't seem to find the comfortable position for his legs.
Are you uncomfortable, Your Holiness?
These galoshes are troubling me, I don't suppose.
But it wasn't the galoshes. Like all his other attendants, the chaplain knew that the patriarch was troubled by pain in one of his legs. The old man tried not to limp, and never mentioned it, but when he was tired, he couldn't conceal it. The chaplain wondered if he should raise the matter with the physician.
Of course, let me help you take them off, he said. You won't need them till we get out.
Oh, that would be very kind. Thank you so much.
As he gently removed the rubber overshoes, the chaplain said,
But you know, Your Holiness, a train carriage especially set aside for the president of the High Council is a very similar kind of thing to the ceremonial and ritual of the Holy Church itself. It marks the natural distance between...
Oh, no, 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 it isn't the same at all. The ceremonies of the church, the liturgy, the music, the vestments, the icons, those are holy things intrinsically. They embody holiness. They have sustained the faith of generations past. Sacred things, Michael. Not at all the same as commandeering a whole railway carriage and leaving those poor people in the rain. Oh, it's very bad, you know. It shouldn't have happened.
A young, dark-suited, smooth-haired attendant was hovering respectfully nearby. When the patriarch's galoshes were safely off, he stepped forward and bowed.
Jean Vautel, Your Serenity, I am blessed enough to have been appointed your new secretary for council business. If you are comfortable, I should like to discuss arrangements for the celebration to mark your election as president. Then there is the matter of...
A celebration? What is this?
A natural expression of the joy of the people, Your Serenity. It would be fitting.
Oh, dear... I hadn't expected anything like that.
Behind the new secretary, St. Simeon could see other men, strangers, but all busy stowing boxes, files, and suitcases on the luggage racks, and all with the same air of competent zeal that Monsieur Vautel exhibited in every pore.
Who are all these people?
He said. Your staff, Your Holiness. Once we are on our way, I'll bring them forward and present them to you. We have done our best to assemble a team of many talents.
But I have a staff already,
the old man said, looking helplessly at the chaplain, who spread his hands and said nothing as the train began to move out of the station. The platform was still thronged with passengers. Malcolm found a cheap place called the Hotel Rembrandt, not far from the lake shore. He registered under one of his false names, found his third-floor room, and left his suitcase there, then went out to find something to eat. There was nothing incriminating in the suitcase, but he plucked out one of his hairs and placed it between the door and the jamb so he could see if anyone had entered while he was out. He found a small brasserie next door to the hotel and ordered pot-au-feu.
I wish... he said. So do I, said Asta. But she did.
Gone to look for your imagination. What a thing to have to read.
What do you think he meant?
Precisely what he said. He felt them both to be, I don't know, diminished, perhaps, because of the way she was thinking, as if part of her had vanished. Perhaps she stopped believing in her imagination because of Talbot, partly. So he set out to find it.
She couldn't have been taken in by that mountebank, surely.
Plenty have been taken in. It's a corrosive thing, his way of thinking. Even corrupting. A sort of universal irresponsibility. Does he say anything specifically about the imagination?
No. From time to time he uses the word imaginative as a term of disparagement, as if in inverted commas, so the readers of the Baltimore Observer can tell he's being ironic. What did you feel when you spoke to him in Oxford? To Pantalaimon, I mean.
Le soleil noir de la mélancolie. He said nothing directly about it, but it was there.
Exactly what I felt about her when we saw her again, said Malcolm. When she was younger, she was fierce, defiant, insolent even. But there was something melancholy about her even then, don't you think?
He sat back as the waiter brought his meal. He noticed a man sitting alone at a small table in the corner of the room, a thin and frail-looking middle-aged man who might have been Central Asian, shabbily dressed, wearing much-repaired wire-framed glasses. He saw Malcolm looking at him and turned away.
Asta murmured, "Interesting. He's talking to his demon in Tajik.
A delegate to the Congress?
Maybe. He doesn't look very pleased with the outcome, if he is.
But thinking of Talbot, I suppose another reason he's popular is that he'd be easy to imitate in an undergraduate essay.
Good on a platform, too. And I think he had read the Hypercharasmians. He didn't want to admit it.
Hard to see why that's popular.
Oh, I don't think so, said Malcolm. It's a gripping story that encourages people not to feel bad about being selfish. Plenty of customers for that point of view.
Surely that's not what Lyra feels.
I can't imagine her ever believing that. But between them, they've done something damaging to her, and Pantalaimon.
It must be due to other things as well.
Asta was crouching sphinx-like on the table, her eyes half-closed. She and Malcolm were communicating with half-murmur, half-thought, and it would have been hard for either of them to say whether a remark originated from him or from her. The pot-au-feu was good. The wine Malcolm was drinking was passable. The room was warm and comfortable. It was tempting to relax, but he and Asta kept each other awake.
"He's watching us again," she murmured.
"Was he watching us before? We were watching him?"
"Yes. He's curious, but nervous, too. Shall we speak to him?"
"No. I'm a respectable Swiss businessman away from home to show samples of my products to local retailers. It's not likely that I'd be interested in him. Keep watching, but don't let him see."
The Tajik man was eating a frugal meal as slowly as he could, or that was what it looked like to Asta.
"Perhaps he's staying in here for the warmth," Malcolm said.
He was still there when Malcolm finished and paid the bill, and he watched them leave. Malcolm gave him another glance as he closed the door. The man's expression was somber as their eyes met. Malcolm was cold and tired. No one had disturbed the door. They went to bed, and Asta dozed on the pillow beside him as he read some of Jahan and Roxana before going to sleep. At 2 in the morning there came a knock on his door. He and Asta woke at once, though the knock was very soft. Malcolm was out of bed in a second. He whispered through the door,
"Who's that?" "Monsieur, I need to speak to you."
The voice was that of the Tajik man. There was no doubt about it. He spoke French, like Malcolm, but his accent was familiar, even in a whisper, even through a door.
"A moment," said Malcolm,
and pulled on shirt and trousers. He unlocked the door as quietly as he could. It was the Tajik man, and he was frightened. The serpent demon around his neck was gazing back along the dim-lit corridor. Malcolm offered him the only chair and sat on the bed himself.
"Who are you?" he said. "My name is Merzat Karimov. Monsieur, is your name Polstead?"
"Yes. Why do you want to know?"
"So I can warn you about Marcel Delamere."
How do you know Marcel Delamere?
I have had dealings with him. He has not paid me, and I cannot leave until he does.
You said you wanted to warn me. What about?
He has learned of your presence in the city, and has ordered a watch kept on every road, on the railway station and on the ferry terminals. He wants to capture you. I heard this from a man I befriended at Les Maisons Justes, who took pity on my situation. And now, monsieur, I think you had better leave quickly, because I saw from my window that the police are actively searching the houses nearby. I do not know what to do.
Malcolm went to the window, stood to one side, and pulled the threadbare curtain away from the wall just enough to see out. There was some kind of movement at the end of the street, and three men in uniform talking under a streetlight. He let the curtain fall and turned back.
"Well, Monsieur Karimov," he said, "I think that, what is it now, 2:30 in the morning would be a very good time to leave Geneva. I'm going to steal a boat. Will you come with me?"
Chapter 19. The Professor of Certainty. Pantelimon had never felt so exposed, except for the terrible first hours of separation from Lyra on the shores of the world of the dead. But even there, he hadn't been lonely, because with him then was Will's demon, who knew nothing about herself and hadn't even known she existed till she was torn out of his heart. As the little boat had borne Will and Lyra away into the darkness, the two demons had shivered on the misty shore, embracing each other for warmth, and Pan had tried to explain everything to the terrified creature who didn't know her name or what shape she was, or even that she could change. And on his journey up the River Elbe, through cities and forests and well-tended fields, he often thought back to that desolate time, made warm by their companionship, and wished above everything for a companion now. He even wished for Lyra. If only they were making this journey together, it would be an adventure. It would be filled with love and excitement. What had he done to her? How must she be feeling now? Was she still at the Trout in Godstow? Or was she looking for him? Was she safe? It nearly made him stop and go back. But he was doing this for her. She was incomplete. Something had been stolen from her, and he was going to get it back. That was why he crept along riverbanks and past power stations, and slipped aboard barges laden with rice or sugar or slates or guano, and scampered through boatyards and along wharves and embankments, keeping to the shadows, staying in the undergrowth, avoiding the daylight, alert to every threat from every direction. Cats wouldn't take him on, but several times he had to flee from dogs, and once from wolves, and always and everywhere hide from human beings and their demons. But finally, he reached Wittenberg, and then came the even harder problem of finding the house of Gottfried Brander. What would Lyra do? Well, he thought, to start with, she'd probably go to a library and look in local reference books or town directories of one sort or another, and if those things failed, she'd start asking directly. Well-known people could never really keep their addresses secret. The postal authorities would know them. Doubtless local newspapers would know too. Even passers-by in the street or the marketplace might have an idea where the city's most famous resident lived, and Lyra was very good at asking people things. But those ways were impossible for a demon on his own. The barge he arrived on was tied up to a buoy in the river, because the nearest quay was fully occupied. Pan waited until it was fully dark, and then slipped over the side and swam through the icy water to a patch of bare ground under some trees. The earth was frost-hard, the air still and heavy with the smells of coal and timber, and something sweet that might have been molasses. Further back downstream, just outside the city walls, the barge had passed an area of tents and rough shanties, where people had been cooking over fires, or sleeping huddled under blankets of canvas or roofs of cardboard. Pan could see the glow of the fires still, and smell the wood smoke, and for a minute he was tempted to go back and investigate. But then he shook himself dry and ran away from the river and into the city, keeping close to the walls, looking at everything. The narrow streets were lit by gas lamps, whose soft light cast soft shadows. Pan moved with obsessive care, only leaving the darkness of an alley or an oratory porch when he was sure there was no one looking, and skirting the edges of the open squares and marketplaces. There were few people about. It was clearly a well-behaved city that went to bed early and took a dim view of pleasure. Everything was clean. Even the refuse outside kitchen doors was separated into precisely labelled municipal bins. Pan thought it was going to be impossible. How could he ever find out where Branda lived without asking someone? But how could he, a demon on his own, speak to anyone without making himself horribly conspicuous? The doubts increased, and then he found himself thinking of something else. What was he actually going to do when he came face to face with the author of the Hypercharasmians, assuming he ever did? Why had he never thought about that? He crouched under a box bush in a little expanse of grass and trees in a triangle of space where three roads met. It was a residential area. Tall, neat houses, an oratory with a spire, some other kind of building in a large garden. The trees were bare. It would be some time before spring woke them up. Pan was cold and tired and discouraged, and he longed more than ever for Lyra's arms, for her breast, for her lap. He had been utterly reckless, utterly foolish, petulant, selfish and proud. He hated what he'd done. He hated himself. There was a signboard above the wall around the garden across the street. It stood under a large conifer, and there was no street lamp nearby. But just then, a tram came past, and in its headlights and the glow from the lighted interior, he read the words, St. Lucia, Schule für Blinde. A school for the blind. As soon as the tram had turned a corner, he darted across the road and leaped up to the top of the wall, and from there into the pine tree, and a minute later he was curled up in a comfortable fork in the branches, where he fell asleep at once. In the dawn, Pan scouted the school grounds and the outbuildings. It wasn't a large place, but it was carefully tended and as clean and tidy as the rest of the city. The main school building was built with brick and plain almost to the point of severity, so much like St. Sophia's College, in fact, that the sight of it in the early light brought a pang of homesickness. On the other side of the main building was a neat garden, bare at this time of year, but with a little fountain playing in a pool, and a gravel drive leading to the main gates. Pan wasn't sure what he'd do, but not being seen would be just like being invisible, and he'd improvise when the time came. He found a dense little shrubbery at one side of a close-cut lawn, from which he could see the whole of the main building, and settled down to watch. It was a boarding school for girls. He was familiar with the sort of routine that governed the day in such a place, and he listened to the bell that signalled time to get up and time to go to breakfast, the sounds of female voices, the clatter of knives and forks on china plates, and he smelled the fragrance of toast and coffee. And he saw shutters over dormitory windows being opened wide, lights coming on, adult figures moving to and fro. And then breakfast was over, and from another part of the building came the sound of young voices raised in a hymn. He knew it all so well. At some point in the morning, the pupils would come out for air and exercise, and then he'd take whatever chance he could find. In the meantime, he explored the school grounds. Behind the shrubbery was a continuation of the stone wall he'd scaled to get in, and he could hear a busy street on the other side of it. He'd be able to escape that way if he really needed to, but he didn't want to leap down among pedestrians and traffic. It would be better to find a quieter corner where he wouldn't be so conspicuous, and he found one behind a wooden shed that contained gardening tools. Right now, however, the shrubbery was the best place to hide, so he went back there and made a discovery. Someone had created a little shelter from branches and leaves against a big pine trunk on the side that faced away from the school. The way to it was thickly overgrown, and would have been hard for an adult to get through. But a young person, if they were slim, would be able to do it easily. Inside the shelter, Pan found a tin box under a heap of dry leaves. It was locked, and it was heavy with the sort of weight a thick book would give it. Someone's secret diary? But how could she write if she couldn't see? He heard the bell ring and put everything back. Then he climbed the tree trunk a little way and waited. It wasn't long before she came. She was about 14 years old
and slender and dark-haired. She wore a skirt and blouse of blue cotton and a paint-stained white apron, and her bare knees were badly scratched, no doubt from the bushes she'd had to push her way through in order to hide the box. Her demon was a chinchilla. Pan watched as she felt for the leaves, pulled out the tin, and unlocked it with a little key on a chain around her wrist. She took out a battered book, as thick and heavy as Pan had guessed, and settled down with her back against the tree trunk to read it. What he hadn't realized was that the book was thick, because, of course, it was printed in the raised dot alphabet that blind people could read with their fingers. As she moved her hand across the page, she whispered to the little demon on her shoulder, reading it aloud to him. Within a minute, they were both completely engrossed in the story. Pan felt bad to be spying on them, so he climbed down the trunk, taking care to scratch his claws on the rough bark so they could hear him coming. They both heard and turned their faces up in alarm. "I'm sorry to interrupt you," Pan said in the German he and Lyra had both struggled with for years until they began to memorize poetry in it.
"Who are you?"
the girl whispered.
"Only a demon," he said. "My girl is nearby, watching to see if anyone comes." "So you're not blind? What are you doing here?"
"Just exploring. My name is Pantaleimon. What's yours?"
"Anna Weber and Gustavo."
"May I sit with you for a little?"
"Yes, if you tell me what shape you have."
He didn't know the German word. The chinchilla demon had no more sight than she did, but his other senses were briskly alert. He touched noses with Pan and sniffed and twitched his ears, and then whispered to Anna. She nodded.
"Mada," she said.
"Oh, in my language, it's Martin."
"What are you reading?"
She blushed. Pan wondered whether she knew he could notice.
"It's a love story," she said. "But one we're not supposed to know about, because it's kind of grown up. That's why I hide it out here. My friend lent it to me."
"We read a lot, me and Lyra."
"That's a strange name."
"Have you read the Hypercharasmians?"
"Oh, no. Oh, but we'd love to. We're longing to read that. But the school won't allow it. One older girl got into terrible trouble for bringing it in. You know, the author lives here, in this city."
Pan felt a shiver of luck.
"Does he? Do you know where?" "Yes, he's famous. People come from all over the world to visit him."
"Where is his house?"
"In the street behind the Stadtkirche. They say he never leaves it, his house, I mean, because he's so famous, and people stop him to talk all the time."
"Why won't the school let you read it?"
"Because it's dangerous," she said. "Lots of people think so. But it sounds so exciting. Did you read it with Ira?"
"Yes. We didn't agree about it."
"I'd love to hear what she thought about it. Was it as exciting as people say?"
"Yes, it was, but..." The bell rang. Anna closed her book at once and felt for the tin box.
"I've got to go in," she said. "They don't give us long. Will you come and talk to us again?"
"If I can, I'd like to. Do you know what Branda's house looks like?"
"Sorry, that was a silly question." "Well, no, but it's called the Kaufmann's house. It's famous."
She swiftly and deftly locked the box and thrust it back among the leaves.
"Bye,"
she said, and scrambled away through the undergrowth. Pan felt bad about deceiving her. If he and Lyra were ever reconciled, he'd make sure they came back here to visit Anna and bring her some books. But the luck! He felt as they'd done in the Arctic town of Trollesund, meeting the aeronaut Lee Scoresby and Yorick Bernerson, the armored bear, the very best allies they could possibly have found. That felt as if he and Lyra had been blessed, or as if some power was looking after them. And so did this. He moved quietly around the grounds until he came to the caretaker's hut, and then jumped up on the roof, and then across onto the wall. The narrow side street on the other side was deserted,
but he could hear the sound of traffic from the main road beyond the school. To be safe, he should wait till dark, and he knew it. But it was so tempting to jump down and run hard. In which direction, though? She'd mentioned the Stadtkirche, the town church. Pan looked around, but the tall houses blocked the view ahead. Keeping low, he scampered along till he came to the spot where he'd entered the grounds the night before. Through the branches of the bare trees on the little triangle of grass, he could see two square towers of pale stone, each capped with a black dome and lantern. That might be it. Before he could stop himself, he leaped down from the wall and raced into the street just after two trams had crossed in the middle. One or two pedestrians saw him and blinked or shook their heads, but he was across too soon for anyone to see him clearly, and then he scrambled up the trunk of an old cedar and vanished from view. He looked down carefully and saw that the passers-by were moving on as if nothing had happened. Perhaps they thought their eyes were tricking them. He climbed round the trunk a little way and looked for the towers of the Stadtkirche and soon found them again. Maybe he could get there by moving from roof to roof. The houses were tall and narrow, with no gaps between them, opening directly onto the pavement without the little basement area that was common in English townhouses. He darted across the road and into a small alley, climbed a drainpipe, and then slipped into the gutter it drained, and then onto the tiles and up to the ridge of a roof. Now he could see the church towers in the pale sunlight, and many other tall buildings besides, and no one could see him. It was almost like being on the roof of Jordan College long ago. He settled down to sleep by a warm chimney and dreamed of Lyra.
"Wittenberg," said Olivier Bonneville aloud and jubilantly.
He couldn't stop himself, and it didn't matter, because he was alone in his cabin on the old river steamer, which was right over the engine room. The clanking and wheezing and thudding was more than enough to cover his voice, had anyone been listening outside. He'd been watching Pantalaimon with the alethiometer ever since he'd first seen him on the riverbank, in brief snatches, so as not to let the nausea build up. It wasn't long before he realized that Lyra's demon was travelling up the Elbe. Bonneville travelled at once by train to Dresden, further up the river from wherever Pantalaimon was, where he booked a cabin on this surely soon-to-be-retired steamboat, which travelled strenuously up and down the river between Prague and Hamburg. They were in Meissen when he saw Pan climb up the side of a building and look across the rooftops towards a church with two towers. It was a familiar sight. There was an engraving showing the famous Wittenberg Stadtkirche on the wall of Marcel Delamere's office. Bonneville swiftly shuffled through the scatter of papers on his bunk and found the boat company's timetable. Meissen was 6 hours' journey from Wittenberg. Not long now, in fact. Rooftop to rooftop. Pan should have thought of that before. The old houses were built joining one another, or with only a very narrow alley between them, and people seldom looked up, because their attention was focused at ground level in traffic and cafes and shop windows. Pan's nature was suited to high things, and his footing was secure. So, rooftops it was. He scouted the whole district, unseen and unsuspected by those below. In the early afternoon, he found a house that looked promising, just behind the Stadtkirche, as the girl had said. And by creeping down a drainpipe and looking across the street, he could even make out the words, "Der Kaufmannshaus," in Gothic letters on a brass plate by the front door. There was little traffic. It was a very quiet street. He took a risk and ran across, making for an alley 3 or 4 houses further along, and then there was another climb, and then he was on the roof of Gottfried Brander's house. It was steeper than its neighbours, but the tiles gave Pan quite enough grip. He made his way over the ridge, past a cluster of tall brick chimneys, and down towards the rear of the house. There was someone playing in the garden. That there was a garden at all was surprising, because none of the other houses he could see had more than a small paved courtyard. But the Kaufmann's house had a square of grass, 2 or 3 small trees, and a summer house where a girl was throwing a ball against the wooden wall and spinning round before trying to catch it. He could hear the regular thud of the ball, the little gasps of satisfaction when she caught it, the hisses of disappointment when she didn't. Her demon was something so small he couldn't make it out, just a little scamper on the lawn. He might have been a mouse. Was there any point in waiting? Of course not. Pan looked down from the gutter and saw to his satisfaction that the rear wall of the house was covered in ivy. A moment later, he was moving down through the leaves silently, watching the girl as he did. She didn't notice. As he reached the gravel path at the foot of the wall, she threw the ball again, spun round, and this time stopped halfway round, because she saw him. The ball hit her on the shoulder and fell to the grass. She snapped a cross word and picked it up, and then turned back to throw it again, ignoring Pan. He was still at the foot of the wall, under a tall window. He watched her throw the ball again and again, taking no notice of him, and then he stalked across the path, making no noise at all, and walked across the grass towards her, and sat down in the shadow of the house, only a few feet away from the girl. She could see him without even turning her head, but she went on playing as if he wasn't there. She was about 15 years old, blonde-haired and slender, with an expression of discontent that looked as though it had settled on her face for life. Two little frown lines had already marked her forehead. She wore a formal white dress with puffed sleeves, and her hair was tied up elaborately. The dress was too young for her, and the hairstyle too old. She looked as if nothing about her was right, and she knew it. Throw, thud, spin, catch. The mouse demon had seen Pan, and made a movement as if to approach him, but she saw and hissed. The demon stopped and crept back. Throw, thud, spin, drop. Pan said, "Is this the house of Gottfried Brander?"
"What if it is?"
she said, snatching up the ball from the ground. "I've come a long way to see him."
"He won't talk to you."
"How do you know?" She shrugged and threw the ball again, and caught it. "Why are you playing a little children's game?" Pan said.
"Because he pays me to."
"What? Why?"
"It gives him pleasure, I suppose. He watches me from the window. He's working now, but he still likes to hear the sound."
Pan looked at the house. There was no sign of movement, but the ground floor window facing the garden was slightly open.
"Can he hear us talking?"
Another shrug, another catch. He said, "Why won't he talk to me?"
"He won't even look at you. What are you doing on your own, anyway? It's not natural. Where's your person?"
"I'm looking for her imagination."
"You think he's got it?"
"I think he stole it."
"What would he want with that?"
"I don't know, but I've come to ask him about it."
She looked at him then, disdainfully. The last of the watery sunshine was just touching the top of the two trees. The shadow of the house across the garden was already chilling the air.
"What's your name?" Pan said.
"Nothing to do with you. Oh, this is too strange for me."
She threw the ball to the ground and turned away, shoulders slumped. Then she sat down on the step of the summer house, and her demon ran up her arm and buried his face in her hair.
"Does he pay you to play all day long?" Pan asked.
"He's given up everything else."
He tried to think what that could mean. She wasn't likely to give him a clear answer.
"Is he in the house now?"
"Where else? He never goes out."
"Which room would he be in?"
She sat up impatiently.
"Oh, for God's sake! The study, of course. That open window."
"Is there anyone else there apart from him?"
"Well, there are servants, naturally. It won't do you any good, you know."
"Why are you so sure?"
She gave a heavy sigh, as if his question was too stupid to deserve an answer. Then she turned away, leaned over, and laid her head on her folded arms. two glittering little black eyes stared at him from the fortress of her hair.
"Go away,"
she said, her voice muffled.
"Too many ghosts. You think yours are fast? They keep coming back, and he won't say a word."
Pan wasn't sure what he'd heard. He wanted to know much more about this discontented girl. So would Lyra, he thought, but she'd know how to talk to her, and he didn't.
"Thanks,"
he said quietly. He left her and ran across the lawn. There was a light in the study window now, or perhaps he only noticed it because the late afternoon light was fading fast. He saw an open window on the floor above, and scampered up the ivy and darted through. He found himself in a bedroom. It was austere like a monk's cell. Bare floorboards, no pictures or bookshelves. One narrow bed with thin bedclothes very tightly tucked in. A bedside table with nothing but a glass of water on it. The door was slightly open. He went through, and made his way down the steep stairs into a dark hall, with a door nearby that led, to judge from the smell of cabbage, to the kitchen, and another door from which came a powerful smell of smoke leaf. He crept along the wall, trying to make no noise with his claws on the polished wooden floor, and paused outside that door. Branda's voice, it could only have been his, clear and forceful and precise, sounded as if he were giving a lecture.
"And it is clear that no further examples are necessary. Here the reign of stupidity comes to its final phase, characterized at first by a bloom of decadence, and then by the flowering of every kind of extravagant, timorous, and crepuscular piety. At this point..."
"Sorry, Professor," came in a woman's voice. "What sort of piety?"
"Extravagant, timorous, and crepuscular."
"Thank you. Sorry."
"You have not worked for me before, I think."
No, Professor. The agency explained..."
"Continue. At this point, everything is in place for the coming of the strong leader, which will form the subject of the next chapter." He stopped. There was silence for a few seconds. "That is all," he said. "Kindly tell the agency that I would be obliged if they would send a different stenographer tomorrow."
"I'm sorry, Professor. I was the only person available."
"Are you sorry? If it is your fault, you should be sorry. If it is not, there is no blame to be sorry for. A mistake is your fault. An incapacity is not."
I know I'm not used to... I trained for business and commerce, and the terms you use are unfamiliar. I know you want to get it right."
"It is right."
"Of course. Sorry."
"Goodbye," he said, and Pan heard the sound of a chair being moved, some papers being stacked, a match being struck.
A few moments later, a young woman came out of the room, shrugging herself into a shabby overcoat and trying to hold back a bundle of papers and a pen case from falling on the floor. It was no use. They tumbled out from under her arm, and the parrot demon who'd flown to the newel post of the stairs said something disparaging. She ignored him and bent to pick them up, and at the same moment she caught sight of Pan, who had nowhere to hide. He tried to stand as still as possible against the wall. Her eyes widened. She took a sharp breath, and her demon uttered a quiet squawk of alarm. Pan's eyes met hers. He shook his head.
"It's not possible,"
she whispered.
"No,"
he whispered back.
"Not possible."
The parrot was actually whimpering. From the doorway came a strong smell of smoke leaf. The young woman scooped up her papers and hastened to open the front door and leave, even before she had her coat fully over her shoulders. The parrot flew ahead of her, and the door slammed shut. But there was nothing to be gained by waiting. Pan walked through the doorway, into the cigar-burdened, book-lined study, where Gottfried Branda was sitting at a large desk, watching him. He was a large-boned man, gaunt and stiff, with short grey hair and very light blue eyes. He was dressed formally, as if he were about to give an academic lecture, and his expression was one of stark terror. Pan looked for his demon. She was a very large German shepherd, and she lay on the carpet at his feet, apparently asleep, or pretending to be. She looked as if she were trying to make her great size as small as possible. Branda hadn't moved, but he looked away from Pan and stared into the corner of the room. Unless that was the natural expression his face fell into, the terror still possessed him. Pan was disconcerted. Of all the reactions he'd expected, this was not one. He stalked across the room and leaped up onto the desk. Branda closed his eyes and turned his body away.
"You've stolen Lyra's imagination," said Pan.
No movement from Branda, not a word.
"You've stolen it," Pan said,